Hi, folks. Bill Resnick talking to John Bellamy Foster, part two of my interview with John, who teaches sociology at the University of Oregon, also lead editor of the Monthly Journal, Monthly Review. He's written 10 books and edited 10 others. They include The Ecological Rift, Capitalism's War on the Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. We discuss the future of the world as it continuously warms, wreaking havoc, vast destructive storms, spiraling food prices, whole populations desperately fleeing, ocean level rise, flooding most of the big cities of the world on the coasts, and more. At some point in this ruinous trajectory, people around the world will awake and demand the total mobilization of all Earth's resources to stop the current death march. We conclude today discussing what must be done, and that we have all the necessary resources and technologies to succeed. Another better sustainable and democratic world is necessary, and it's possible. So, John, first the future. First the time we have left to meet the climate threat. Not much time, I'm afraid. And then how and for what the left can organize.
Yeah, I agree with the things that you say. In terms of the 2030 and 2050 marker, 2030 is really about getting carbon emissions down by at least 30% and from where we are now. And that doesn't mean that we're talking about waiting till 2030. We can't. This is 2023, and there are 7 years in which the world has to somehow reduce carbon emissions by about 30%, and then 20 years after that, carbon emissions have to go down to, well, by 2030, it's really by 40%. And by 2050, we have to hit net zero carbon emissions is the way they refer to it. But we basically have to eliminate carbon emissions by 2050. So you got 7 years to get the emissions down by 40%. And 20 years after that, we have to get down to zero. And so this is, you know, to even talk about that is not talking about waiting. It's talking about we need to reducing our carbon emissions on a daily basis. We need a transformation of the entire production system of the world and on a revolutionary scale. And this is what the science is now saying. The mitigation report of the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their AR6 report, and the mitigation part of that, the part three that came out last year, said that we had to pursue low energy solutions. It's understood in the science now that we don't have any technological solutions. Certainly we can promote solar and wind, but we don't have any technological solutions like carbon capture and sequestration. They don't even exist on scale or nuclear or anything else that can solve this problem. And you know, what we need is to actually reduce energy usage by changing the way in which the economy operates. So we need low energy strategies now. And we can do things that reduce energy usage, but we have to have a different kind of production system and a different set of priorities. And that's what the IPCC report was saying. Only that's what the scientists wrote, but the governments have the right to censor the summary of policymakers written by the scientists. So the governments came in and they rewrote the whole statement of the scientists before it was published. We know this because it was leaked. The original report was leaked and we put it up on the Monthly Review site. So we know what the science said as opposed to what the government said. And the governments came in and removed what the scientists said about the need for low energy solutions. They removed what the scientists said about eliminating coal-fired plants and so on right down the line. So we're being lied to in terms of what the governments are telling us, even through the IPCC, and keeping us from hearing what the science demands. The great UK medical journal, The Lancet, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, just came out last week with a big report saying that the only solution was low energy solutions, and this would require a restructuring, transformation of our entire production system to create a society also that was more equal, because we can't reduce the energy usage to the extent that is needed without also creating a more egalitarian system. They require each other. So we know these things at this point. What you said about there probably being extreme weather events that coalesce in the next decade that will create enormous emergencies all over the world, we're already seeing that. And the part two of the latest IPCC climate report basically deals with the damages. It spelled that out. Well, parts one and two spelled that out, that we're facing these extreme coalescing weather events, things like the wildfires in Oregon, you know, combined with drought and whole regions moving from drought to floods. Look at Pakistan. They had the more that you have global warming, the more you have water remains in the air, and the monsoon was increased as a result of their heat waves and their drought. The monsoon was increased, and then they had floods that flooded 30% of the country. And these things are going to be more common all around the world. And it's not just a question of what we do or experience here in the United States. It's all over the planet. And this is a situation where, in the last summer's issue of Month's Review, the July-August issue, we had an issue on socialism and ecological survival, because it's now necessary, since we haven't done things and because the extreme weather events are now on us in a very real way and can't be stopped. Although we haven't reached planetary tipping points, the damage to our societies and to people, the cities and everything is becoming immense. We have to think about on a community level in terms of our organizations. We have to think about designing things for survival, not in terms of the elitist notion of resilience, which is all about putting this on the back of individuals or poor people, but actually creating organizations for ecological survival that protect people and communities, and particularly the poor. And from that, we can also develop the organizations. We also have to fight for mitigation. We have to fight on an immensely greater scale to stop the climate change and to stop these other forms of environmental destruction, or we won't have anything left. So it really is an immediate and pressing responsibility of everyone. And we're sort of collectively, like Nero, basically playing the fiddle while Rome burns. We're seeing the planet already destabilizing, at least as a safe home for humanity. And what are we doing? Well, we sent over $100 billion this last year in military equipment to Ukraine. Now, whatever, you know, you can look at the Ukraine war in various ways, but they've said that there's no money to deal with climate change, that we can't really, you know, we can't have an emergency government program. We don't have the money for it. But suddenly we have more than $100 billion in a year for a war. And we have to get our priorities straight, because the entire planet and the population of the Earth is in danger. I expect the organizing on this to come principally from the global south at first, because in the United States, this is Fortress America. We tend to, this is the, really the most conservative place on Earth, and at least our system has given us that role. We're at the core of the global imperial system, so we tend to not act and try to retain our power. And right now, the United States is expanding pipelines, spending trillions of dollars expanding pipelines and fracking, and we're sending oil and natural gas abroad. We're now the leading producer of fossil fuels on the Earth, selling it all over the world. And this is contributing to climate change. And we pretend that we're protecting the environment because our emissions have gone down somewhat, but we are now the biggest producer of fossil fuels in the Earth. And if you have a look at, there are studies of excess carbon emissions. And in the carbon budget, every country has a certain fair share of carbon emissions, historic carbon emissions. based on their population. They had a certain share of the global per capita emissions. And the United States, its historic emissions are, by subtracting the fair share from the amount of emissions the country has actually had, you can determine what countries have had excess emissions beyond their fair share. And 40% of all the excess carbon emissions in the world have been produced by the United States or have been consumed by the United States or part of U.S. consumption, U.S. emissions. So we account for 40% of the excess emissions in the entire world. We're way beyond our per capita share, and we have a responsibility for it. And if Americans organize on this basis and recognize, and of course we have to be concerned on this issue with the entire planet, we can have an effect because the U.S. is at the core of the system. And my strategy, one of my strategies would be, let's make the fossil fuel companies the enemies, not just in terms of a disinvestment project, but let's just organize completely against fossil fuel companies. They're the fascists of our time, let's say. Create a popular front between radicals, working class, and people within the elites who realize that we have to protect the earth, and go after the fossil fuel companies, make them the enemy, and do everything we can to obstruct them, to stop them, to block them. That's one strategy. We have a lot of things we can do, but we have to organize, and we have to have principles of organization. And we actually have to realize that there's an enemy out there. This isn't caused by the population as a whole. It's really caused by a system that is irrational and destructive and is the enemy of us all. And that's really capitalism. But we could target fossil fuel capital or fossil capital and organize on that basis. So far, that hasn't been tried.
Hi, folks. You're listening to KB Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here talking to John Bellamy Foster, whose specialty is showing why capitalism cannot stop. That the dominant elites of the world, if most recognize the climate roasting threat, they have deceived themselves that we can make it, they think, with new technologies and just continue capitalist growth and permit them to buy ever bigger yachts. That means that it's us progressives and must gain the authority to direct the mobilization of our great resources that could vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and end global warming. That mobilization, of course, would require convincing the United States public that we, humanity, must embark on four courses of action. The first two have, in fact, long been priorities of our climate action groups and movements. And we have shown that technologies that capital wants to rely on either don't work, like carbon taxes, or are dangerous, like nuclear plants and geoengineering, or are very expensive and require years of research and build-out. The second objective, we conducted campaigns of civil disobedience to stop fossil fuel exploration, extraction, refining, and transportation. We have come a long way towards convincing that fossil fuel burning must be ended and the fossil fuel industry shut down and dismantled. And that will become more clear as global warming becomes more dangerous and destructive. It is the other two of the four objectives that require a great increase in the work of the climate action movement. So the third objective is demonstrating that we, humanity, can succeed in stopping global roasting and in the process create a healthier and more democratic societies, that we can do it quickly and relatively cheaply, that we have a solution to make our cities, especially because they are responsible for 70% or so of today's greenhouse gas pollution, to build out in the cities renewable sun and wind energy, and also many larger installations within 100 miles. Why? To avoid the time and vast expense of locating our sun and wind plantations way out in the countryside, and to bring the electricity to consumers, we'd have to build hundreds of thousands of miles of big nature-destroying grids that are only as reliable as their most vulnerable pylons. Finally, also vitally important, objective four, We'll have to transform all our production and living systems to use less energy. Why? Because if we need ever more energy, even from renewable sources, it will require more installations, more resources, and more time. How to reduce energy needs? Start with building out convenient public transport and investing in other transportation alternatives like biking and walking, all reducing the need for cars and reducing noise and congestion. So, John Foster, elaborate on all this, the need for an economic and social transformation.
Well, I agree with all that you said about model cities, and I was actually commenting on that in terms of survival strategies, because now it's really a question of survival. These things have to be done out of necessity, but we can also see it in terms of improvements of life, more collective, sustainable existence, showing that we can live differently and better, that in some ways smaller but better. And there are all sorts of things that we can do, and you listed quite a few of them. And I think that that has to be done on a community level, and it has to be seen now not simply as some sort of moral, ethical issue, but actually as an issue of human survival that corresponds with human freedom, because I think freedom and necessity are coming together. We have to create a more social, equitable world, a more collective way of living, one where we're concerned with the welfare of all, in order to have a rational approach to our environment and for purposes of survival. So the necessity and issues of social freedom come together in a way that is quite remarkable in our time. And yeah, I know what you're saying about cities. I mean, I remember being in Brussels in Belgium, and on Sundays they stop all traffic going into the inner city, and then I mean they will have trains that come up to the outskirts of the city, but there're no cars in the middle of the city. And it's just remarkable being able to walk in the middle of a modern city, a major city like that, and there are no cars. Everybody is walking through the city. It creates instant community. It creates an instant sense of collectivity and sustainability and really kind of a sense of freedom. And you know, we in the United States associate cars with freedom, but it's only because we have no alternatives in terms of transportation, and otherwise you're stuck. But in my classes, I was talking to students about, for example, cars and driving, and said, well, we could reduce our automobile emissions by 10%. And students said, well, that's not possible. We couldn't do that. And I said, well, sure, you could. We could just drive 10% less, quite apart from technological aspects. And we could set up a system that required 10% less automobile driving. After all, we're the most automobile-dependent nation on Earth, and it's totally irrational. We could save energy and so on in that way. And it's just, we talk as though we live in a rational system in terms of energy use and in terms of what we produce, so that if we have a solution to climate change, we still have to produce all this stuff and we still have to use as much energy as before, but that's irrational. First of all, we have all these other environmental problems that are also the product of our economy. I didn't mention, when I was going over planetary boundaries, ocean acidification, which is another great issue, which is a result of carbon dioxide as well. But we have all of these problems, and it's not true that all the stuff that we produce is necessary and rational and meets human needs. In fact, the great bulk of it is actually waste by any standard, ecological waste, social waste, human waste, because human labor goes into producing it. So we have to rethink all of these things. And if we weren't such a destructive and wasteful society, we could use those resources to actually meet human needs and create a more sustainable society. And we can build this from the community level up. But we also have to be concerned, since time is so short and we don't want to cross these planetary boundaries, we can't, because we're looking in the face of human extinction. And if we go very far down this road in the next couple of decades, I mean, that's all we've got to in order to transform this, really, according to the science. We have to be operating also at a national level. We have to find a way to stop the fossil fuel companies and from taking all these fossil fuels out of the ground, and then they're emitted all over the globe, whether it's emitted by us or not. We have to keep the fossil fuels in the ground. So we're now in the middle of the greatest struggle of all human history, and I don't know if we will win, but I do know that hundreds of millions, even billions of people around the world will be drawn into this struggle to save the planet as a safe place for humanity and to create a more collective, sustainable, and egalitarian world. And what we can do is join that struggle, and as hard in as many ways as we can.
Thank you, John Bellamy Foster. He teaches at the University of Oregon. He's written a whole lot of books. They include Ecological Rift, Capitalism, War on Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. His work is animated by recognizing that our system was working to, in fact, extinguish millions of species and possibly Homo sapiens. It's also animated by a recognition that we have all the tools to, in fact, change that very radically and move towards a possible necessary democratic society that gives people real freedom, not just freedom to drive the freeways and cage your iron machine. So thanks a lot for talking to us today, John Bellamy Foster. Let's talk again.
Thank you. I would be glad to.